Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am the conscience of psychiatry. In fact, I don't know anywhere else in the world where you can hear a psychiatrist who is speaking truth to power, speaking truth to authority, giving you a reasoned analysis of therapy, of human behavior, of human nature, not clouded by the pharmaceutical industry, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Medical Association, the National Institute of Mental Health, and even the Department of Education. My guest today is John Snyder, John A. Snyder, spelled S-N-Y-D-E-R. John's a friend of mine, a good man. He's been around as long as I have. I think he claims to have been around even longer. He was educating psychiatrists decades ago, multiple decades ago, on the understanding of depression as an issue of relationship, caring, empathy. In other words, putting depression in the context of being a human being. Eventually, like all of us who do this, he ran into trouble with psychiatry. Perhaps he'll tell you about this today. John wrote a wonderful book, Flying Lessons. I love it. It takes some wonderful stories from his experience as a pilot and tells us about the subtitle, The Psychology of Intimacy and Anxiety. And he has a new book out, Overcoming Depression Without Drugs. I haven't had a chance to look at it yet. I got the book here, but I haven't had much of a chance to look at it. But it's got to be a good book. John writes beautifully, thoughtfully, with feeling. And with that, hello, John Snyder.
Well, hi, Peter. I'm glad that you're actually approving it before you've read it, because that's a good friend. But I know you will. I mean, as you know, we have come from a similar place, and we know the horrors of what has been happening to people with emotional distress in terms of being sold down the river with the pharmaceutical industry. So are you there?
I'm here.
Do you hear me clearly?
Very, very clearly.
Okay, well, Overcoming Depression Without Drugs is basically my attempt to use the experience that I've had for many years working with people with on the dark side of the emotional spectrum and helping them overcome all of these feelings that are now being called depression. The main point of Overcoming Depression Without Drugs actually is that we need to understand that depression, properly understood, is the absence of feelings, not the presence of feelings. Peter, you and I spent time in those back wards where we worked with people who were seriously depressed. Those people were people who lacked feeling. They lacked libido. They lacked any interest in living. They were immobilized by their absence of feeling. It was not a presence of any feelings, an absence of feeling, because these people had to push down, use their life energy, pushing down all of the feelings that they did not want to feel. So that the feelings that we're needing to address are those feelings that people need to entitle themselves to feel and not do some other form of suppression of feelings that the drugs, if they do anything at all, Peter, if they do anything at all, seem to dull people's feeling experience, not help them with it. So that to say that these drugs may cause depression ought to be these drugs will cause depression, because they do exactly the thing that causes depression. People don't get depressed. They depress themselves by refusing to feel a lot of the feelings that are hard for us to feel. So that's the point of the book, and I use as my major case study someone that some people do know and other people could get to know, a composer who went through all of the awful feelings of life, all of those swampland feelings of the soul, and experienced all of what people are taking antidepressant medication for, and he was never depressed because he felt those feelings, and he wrote about them, and he wrote music that expresses them, that can help us sometimes to go to some of those places that are hard for us to go. So that's why the subtitle of the book is Polka with Introductory Funeral March, which was six-year-old Mahler's entitlement of his first composition, which says it all, that his music was about the very lows of life and the very highs of life. So the book is about how not to get depressed, or how not to depress oneself by expressing feelings and finding people who would support one in the expression of those feelings. The empathetic counselors, whether they're professional or not, who understand that what people need to do when they're feeling feelings is feel them. That's my introduction.
John, it's brilliant. It's a brilliant analysis. I really love it. So it's depression is actually the absence of feelings or not dealing with what our real feelings are.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, it very, very well. So what do you find under, when people say they're depressed and then they start to talk with you or me, you know, what kinds of things, feelings begin to come up, and how do they deal with them?
Well, the feelings that come up, Peter, are the primary feelings of life, the ones that all of us, if we're human beings, have to feel from time to time. We sometimes feel hurt. It's impossible to be a human being and not feel hurt. Sometimes we feel scared. It's not possible to be a human being and not sometimes feel scared. Sometimes we feel helpless. It's impossible to be a human being and not feel these feelings. When we were little, if we felt hurt, we cried. If we felt helpless, we cried. Frustrated, we felt cried. If we felt scared in the dark, we cried. So what has happened is that all of these feelings that are normal to human experience, the terrible feelings that people can have if they, a man who's had a successful career and loses his job, is not simply a matter of no money coming in. It's a blow to his whole sense of himself in the world not to be able to work. Lots of feeling in that. We lose a loved one. It depends on how dear that person was, I suppose, and whether it's something we feel terribly sad about or absolutely distraught about. But as you have pointed out, Peter, the extent of feelings is not a sign that they are a disease. The more a person feels has to do with their sensitivity or the extent of whatever it is that is hurting them. There are people, of course, who are dealing with tremendous hurt in terms of rejections, tremendous hurt in terms of feeling unfairly treated. These are all feelings that basically come down to those three simple feelings of hurt, fear, or helplessness, which we all feel. Sometimes it is a very dark place for people. But the point that I want to make in it, of course, is this is not a time to take some kind of medication that people don't even know what they're doing and try to alter the structure of the human brain so you wouldn't have these feelings. It's stupid. Let me go one other place with that. It's also, I'm a psychologist. I'm trained in science. The most important principle in science is about cause and effect. I mean, something, of course, that we've struggled with and have benefited from for the last 300 or 400 years, been very helpful for us. But what is clearly absent here is that congruence does not establish causality. if you have somebody who has troubled feelings, and you could, now Peter, you say that there's some doubt about this, and I would agree, if you could actually find something in the brain that's a little different with this person who has troubled feelings and somebody who doesn't have troubled feelings, I'd say, well, of course, brain's a part of ourselves. I would expect you'd find some trouble there. But to say that what you're seeing in the brain is causing this person the emotional distress is absolutely crazy. It's like...
Let me say, John, I would say that you won't find anything in the brain because it's the brain's normal reaction to stress.
Exactly. So it's not an abnormality. But think about it this way. Back there, let's say 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, and some of our ancestors were planting corn there in Kansas. Now, they didn't plant corn as another vegetable for the table. They planted corn because it was necessary for their survival through those hard, harsh Kansas winters. So it was a matter of life and death for them to have this corn. So they're there, and for a month it hasn't rained. Now 6 weeks it hadn't rained. Oh, my. So they're getting very agitated, frantic. So they start jumping around and stomping on that dry, crusted earth and wailing and moaning and going in circles. And, man, they're in a frenzy, and they exhaust themselves, and they lie down. And it's getting dark. They don't notice that the clouds are coming up, but they wake up there. Hey, come on, there's dark clouds here, man. It's starting to rain. Rain real well here, man. Gosh, the corn's going to be okay. Oh, wow, we've discovered something really important. This rain dancing makes the rain to come. Ooh. Now, what I'm talking about, we got a lot of rain dancers out there telling us something's causing something, and there's no data for it. There's lots of data to suggest that people with troubled feelings will have something going on, just like there's plenty of data to suggest that there's a high-pressure area over the middle part of the United States, big, dry, high-pressure a flow of air that's blocking any movement of air. So, man, it's not raining for a long time, and the low-pressure areas coming along the East Coast that can't move anything are dumping lots of rain on New Jersey, flooding the place. Now, that's not because they did too much rain dancing and the people in Kansas didn't do enough. Come on, we know better. We know better that it's just common sense.
So when somebody's depressed...
My son-in-law's an avid football fan for the Baltimore Ravens. Oh, they came close to in those last playoffs to get really somewhere. And they lost. My son-in-law went into a real funk. I mean, a real funk for days. Now, if I told my son-in-law, well, now look, it doesn't have anything to do with the Ravens losing the game. Actually, your brain kind of misfired, and we've got a thing that'll fix that. We've got a thing that'll fix that, so you won't have these feelings if the Ravens lose. Of course, you won't feel much if they win either. But come on, we can fix all that problem for you. My son-in-law would look at me and say, "John, you're kind of freaking crazy. Why would we want to do that to ourselves?" That's about my book, and that's what I'm trying to say. There's something that we need to look at that's hidden in plain sight here, that there's something really kind of crazy about dealing with human feelings the way that we're told to deal with them when everybody in the country knows what depression is. Depression means somebody's feeling something they don't want to feel. That's not depression.
I like what you're saying. When I'm trying to explain how somebody could be, quote, bipolar without being chemically defective, I use the football analogy of a game where one team is winning and one is losing, and you can just look at each side of the stands, and you can see the people who are losing because they're showing it physically even. They're bent over. They look sad. They're either eating and drinking excessively or they're not eating and drinking, which, of course, proves it's biologic. My colleagues always say, well, it's a somatic disorder, physical disorder. It's affecting appetite, the posture, energy. Well, that all of that's happening on one side of the stands. The other side of the stands is cheering and happy, and they think that they're on top of the world, that nothing could be better, and each person thinks their own personal cheering is actually responsible in part for the good outcome of their team. You know, they're the 12th man on the team. And then, of course, at the end, everything's reversed, and the other team wins, and you get this manic depressive switching. You know, it's rapid cycling. It's rapid cycling into mania on the other side, depression on the side where there was mania. Then when the people leave the stadium, you can see all the body language. You can tell immediately which people come from the losing side, which people come from the winning side. And as with your son, it can carry over for days. We used to joke in Washington, D.C., that whenever the Redskins lost, you know, the male population was depressed, not as much work got done, and the Skins always lost a lot, almost always, except for one Super Bowl they won while I was there. So it was just a lot of toll from that mental illness, a lot of cost in the city. And then, you know, I end up with pointing out that people can get bipolar over football game. Why not over their lives? Make sense to you?
Well, I think that's, yeah, of course it makes such good sense. One wonders how anybody could convince people that these differences in life experience have to do with too little serotonin or too much serotonin or all this nonsense. I mean, obviously any person looking at that wouldn't have anything to do with that. It has to do with a life experience. So that the life experiences that basically bring some feelings of distress to us are not some problem caused by anything going good or bad in the brain. It's basically that there's something happening that can, if we basically want to keep from feeling those feelings, depress ourselves. And so it could be a little bit. If there's some feeling you're not wanting to feel and you push it down a little bit, you get a little depressed. If it's a huge feeling and you push it down, you're going to be majorly depressed. I had an aunt who lost her only son in war, and she was in a family where feelings were just not anything anybody ever allowed expression of. So her grief was just so severely repressed. They gave her ECT, electroshock treatment, Peter. That didn't help a whole lot. Then they did a prefrontal lobotomy, and they did away with whatever grief she was feeling, because now she's just, you know, a person in the world surviving, but without all of the feelings that we are entitled to as human beings. So there's a certain amount of similar kind of orientation. We'll fix this person by doing away with some of these feelings the person doesn't want to feel is just as crazy as a prefrontal lobotomy.
It's all one thing, John, you know. Early in my career, I took several years out of my life to stop lobotomy from coming back. It was a big, massive return of lobotomy, and I worked with Congress, and I spoke all over Europe and North America, and succeeded in really preventing this thing from coming back in the early 70s. Yeah. But what struck me was how much opposition I got from every authoritative branch of the government and the AMA and the APA and so on. And as I began to puzzle over why would everybody in positions of power be opposing my reform work aimed at stopping lobotomy, and it became clearer and clearer to me that the whole history of psychiatry is about damaging the brain while claiming there's something wrong with the person's brain. It's a horrible irony. So we create biochemical imbalances in the brain while claiming the person has biochemical imbalances in the
brain. No question in my experience with people who have been given antidepressant medication that there is a created imbalance in the brain. But see what Antonio Damasio, you know, the neuroscientist who certainly knows about brains, but he is very clear that feelings and thinking are combined, so that if you mess with a person's feeling, you also mess with that person's thinking, so that the brain is a feeling thinking organ, and it's a part of ourselves, so that if you do something that does create some misfunction of the brain, you create problems not only in feelings but in thinking itself. And of course, we have you and I, of course, witness all these strange things that people can do when they're taking antidepressant medication. Some in my practice, of course, are horrible. But the main thing about it is that there was, as you say, the brain was not a problem until you introduced something that creates problems with it. And that's so serious, it should be almost criminal. But again, we're dealing, like you were back then, with power and money and advertising and stuff that, of course, creates an atmosphere where people are basically talked into something that is indeed really hard. One of the things recently I was thinking about, why are people so happy to be called mentally ill? You know, that used to be, you wouldn't want to be called mentally ill, but if you're prescribed an antidepressant medication, you have been defined as mentally ill. And most people, I think, they don't even know that that's in their records. It follows them wherever they go, whatever medical records they have been diagnosed as mentally ill. That people are allowing that to happen to them, again, is a little strange, Peter.
It is strange. We're encouraging moving toward disability more and more. People want to see themselves somehow as partially disabled rather than fully able. And it's very, very bad for our society. It's very, very bad for the individuals. Let's talk a little more about depression, because you're having really good insights into depression.
Well, let me talk about some of the psychiatrists that I'm supervising now who are coming to me because they went through their medical training, their psychiatric training, and interns in residency, and they never had a course in psychotherapy. There was never even an elective offered in terms of psychotherapy. They only knew about drugs. And some of these psychiatrists have basically decided that they don't like it, they don't like what's happening, they don't see it working. Let me just describe one. This psychiatrist basically it couldn't be so simple that these people needed to feel some feelings. But I said, well, just ask this woman that he had been trying to work with for 3 years with antidepressant medication, hadn't gotten anywhere much. I said, just ask her, what is it that you're trying so hard not to feel? He came back 2 weeks later. He said she started talking, then she started crying and said in 2 weeks she's already looking a lot better. Already looking a lot better. She found somebody who cares what she feels and is encouraging the expression of that feeling. It's almost that simple, Peter.
I started to interrupt you before because I want to tell people, I forgot to tell people, that you're going to be doing a two-hour workshop. I don't know if you heard, John, we're giving you 2 hours.
Uh-oh. All right. Well, I'll do it.
You're going to do a two-hour workshop with psychiatrists whom you've been working with on this issue of learning to do therapy. I think it's a miracle that you're going to be doing that at our conference.
I have
April
to say,
13th through 15th. Let me explain to people again. April 13th through 15th, not far from now, in Syracuse, we're going to have all kinds of marvelous presenters, and none better than this workshop that John Snyder is going to be doing with psychiatrists that he's been training and working with as a psychologist. And you can learn about the conference at empathictherapy.org, empathictherapy.org, April 13th to 15th in Syracuse. John, the mic back to you now.
Okay, well, I'm just going to say, as a psychologist, I have these two psychiatrists. I have a clinical social worker and a sex therapist, and we're going to do a panel in which these people are applying these principles and finding just the miracles do happen just by applying some simple principles that people who are showing these symptoms of depression, not depression, showing symptoms that are called depression, if they are given a chance to basically express what they're feeling. Now, this takes sometimes some real understanding on the part of people, because some of these feelings are really powerful, and some people get afraid that people would be feeling this much. So again, empathic therapists, of course, have to understand that they're going to be going through the swamplands of the soul with people when they encourage the expression of feelings, and they need to be able to see the light on the other side. Peter, could I use another illustration?
Sure.
It's one from my experience in flying a little airplane. So I'm flying a little airplane back from North Dakota, heading back to the eastern shore of Maryland, and I've looked at the weather, and there are some storms along, but none that seem to be that much in my path. And I've worked out a pretty good plan going around Chicago to avoid the thunderstorms. Well, as I'm going around Chicago, the air traffic control suddenly says, my call sign 0 Foxtrot, we have an amendment to your route. You need to deviate. You need to turn 20 degrees to the left for traffic. That means there are a lot of planes going into Chicago, and he's got to turn me to the left to keep me from hitting somebody else or somebody hitting me. And I look, and that's going to take me right into one of those puffy, towering cumulus clouds. I think, oh, my. At that point, I think, well, I've been through some of these, and it was pretty rough, but okay, so here we go. Well, I got in there, Peter, and I dropped 2,000 feet. I mean, the seatbelt had just strained. I mean, I'm about to hit my head on the cabin. The seatbelt's about to bust me into. Then I drop 2,000, go up 2,000 feet. Then it gets loud because it's not rain. It's hail banging on the aluminum of that plane. And there's lightning, flashes of lightning, little dances of fire along the front of the plane. Man. Okay, so what I've been trained to do, I want to just turn around and go back where that blue sky was, but the training I have, don't put in any major control inputs. Just do gently keep the wings level, and you'll go through to the other side. Do not try to control the airplane. Let the airplane go up and down. Just keep it a little bit level, and you will go through to the other side. Now, I don't think I believed that at the time, but the truth of it is I didn't have much else to do except follow my training. So I very gingerly just don't do much of anything, and it probably was 10 minutes. It seemed like 10 days. A breakthrough on the other side. Beautiful blue sky, puffy clouds. I mean, it's a beautiful sky, most beautiful sky I've ever seen. Look down there, there's the green grass of northern Indiana. I think I can see far enough to see that little town in Ohio where I'm going to land and spend the night. Man, I was feeling good. Feelings are like that. No matter how stormy they are, if you don't do anything, you just let yourself feel the feelings, you'll come through on the other side. That's my message.
John Snyder, do you have a clinical practice, John?
Yes, I do.
Tell people how they can get in touch with you. Where you are.
I'm trying to train some people to do what I do, Peter, because, well, I'm pretty much booked up, but not necessarily entirely. But I am trying to work with...
John, we got 1 minute, just 1 minute before break. Tell people how to get in touch with you.
Oh, okay. I guess the best thing is the email, and it's John A., has to have the A in it, johnasnyder@verizon.net.
And Snyder is spelled S-N-Y-D-E-R.
D-E-R, correct.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And before we go to break, when we come back from break, I'm going to talk a little bit about my own experiences with sad feelings and some of the things I've learned. I want to make this concrete about how we really can deal with these kinds of feelings. So stay with us. Call your friends. Tell them to tune in. I'm going to talk a little bit about myself. And John Snyder is going to keep on contributing.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, your conscience of psychiatry. interviewing my friend and very respected colleague, John Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R, a psychologist. John, where is your practice?
Practice is in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Peter.
I just want you to tell folks.
Okay, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Good. I want to talk a little bit more specifically about depression, that feeling of not wanting to have feelings, of not wanting to act, of not wanting to be. It's a not wanting life. And beneath it always are intolerable and painful feelings. When I was a young man, and I would get ready to have a cold, I could tell I should have a cold because my wife, my kids might have a cold, I would instead get into a very black mood. I called them my black holes. And I could never figure out what they were, and I never got symptoms of colds. I figured maybe I really wasn't getting colds. Couldn't figure it out. But I knew enough about those black feelings to keep asking, what's going on? What's beneath? What's there? And then one day, it came back to me from my childhood, something that I had totally forgotten. And when I was 12 years old, I'd been at Boy Scout camp, and I'd been wrestling with my best friend. We really got to know each other at the camp. We really liked each other. But it was a terrible camp in those days, a terrible camp. We're going back now a long, long way. And when I got home, we read the newspaper 2 days later and found that my friend had died of acute polio. And first, I was in mourning and loss, but terrified of what would happen to me. Terrified. And we called the doctor, and he didn't even want to see me. He just said, listen, there's nothing I can do, but if he gets a cold or a sore throat or snuffles, give me a call. Well, so powerful was my unconscious, and at first I'm sure my consciousness said, I'm never getting those symptoms. I'm never getting a sore throat. I'm never getting snuffles. I'm never getting a runny nose. And I didn't. And then I never again got them, but I didn't remember anymore this horrific experience at age 12. And the day I remembered this, I was in my early 30s when finally I broke through this black feeling again. I recognized my black hole coming on, maybe a cold, but I'm not getting symptoms. I'm just a little achy. And I got a stiff neck and a runny nose and a sore throat. And I've had normal colds ever since. But I can still sometimes tell when I'm about to get a cold because I get that uneasy feeling again. Now, that's how powerful our unconscious is. First, there's consciousness, and then the pain being too great, the feeling of overwhelming helplessness being too great when I was 12, it became unconscious. And I made it conscious precisely in the way that John Snyder's talking about, by recognizing there was something underneath, something meaningful that I was unable to deal with at the time. John, your thoughts?
Oh, well, that's a big... Peter, thank you, because that's one of the main points that I make in the book, because there's a term called... We call it regression in the service of the ego. Now, most psychologists, when they use that, are using it because they're being very infantile at a convention. And this is regression.
Yes.
But the truth of it is that going back to a place where we had feelings is a recovering of a part of ourselves that we left behind. And so that, and so much of, again, the intensity of feelings is not being caused by what we think it's being caused by. There's something that stimulates the feeling, but it's actually a feeling that that is in there to begin with us, that we're walking around with a lot of feelings, and there's certain things then that stimulate the expression of those feelings. Post-traumatic stress disorder is clearly that. Soldiers out there on the battlefield it doesn't even make any sense if they're feeling scared or helpless or hurt that they sit down and cry. They basically push all those feelings away in order to survive. But when they get back in a safe environment, then all those feelings that came up for them when they were out there, you see, come up in full force. That's not a bad thing. It's like in this environment now, all the normal human feelings of feeling afraid, feeling hurt, feeling confused, all of that stuff is important for somebody to be supported in feeling. But a lot of us have these feelings that we couldn't feel at the time. All kinds of reasons why growing up there's certain feelings that are just not okay to feel. Big boys don't cry. So lots of things that the boys feel that they're not entitled to feel. Feelings of abuse a lot of times where people are talked out of it. Couldn't be true. You're just making trouble. I mean, so that there are feelings there that have to get pushed down. So that what we see, of course, is a kind of an unconscious motivator of behavior. People seem to actually gravitate toward experiences that are like those ones that they didn't want to feel. And that's not a bad thing, because in a better environment, people can be encouraged to feel these feelings. We all have them. They're all human feelings. So your feeling of dread in terms of getting a sniffle, you see, becomes something that you can actually, well, then it's understandable. I would have had a lot of feeling coming up around cold germs. to me, it's a very important principle in terms of understanding. And that's the thing for empathetic therapists, you see, is having as much understanding as possible in terms of what is it like for people to have the feelings that they're having, and where do they come from, and how can they be encouraged to feel them? And I know that's what you want is a whole world of empathetic therapists, so that we're not dependent on psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers. If we have people understanding these principles, goodness knows a spouse can do that for the other person. Just basically encourage the feelings that are coming up, even if they are scary. We can have friends that could do that for us, and we could do it for our friend. It's not something that necessarily takes a lot of professional training. It takes insight. It takes some insight into what is important about feelings except to feel them. And have somebody who cares and would actually say, well, is there every good reason why you'd be feeling this? There's always every good reason why we're feeling whatever we're feeling.
I think choice plays a big role in this, too. I think we not only suppress feelings, we suppress, when we're depressed, rationality and choice. That is, we suppress all of our faculties. And often people get this thing we call depression because they're facing what they feel are unbearable choices. A man wants to, or a woman wants to change jobs but feels it'll be betraying the family not to earn as much living. Or it'll be betraying what mom and dad wanted for them. Maybe it's a young person. They want to not be a doctor or a lawyer like mom and dad want. They want to go into music or art, or they want to be therapists, not get a medical degree. People making choices that they feel are intolerable and painful. So, again, the underlying pain comes through. And often finding the courage to have feelings and finding the courage to make choices are very, very closely related. And I'd like therapists to be thinking not just about the person's feelings, but their rational decision making and what it is they want to do with their lives, what it is they may be afraid to do or feel unentitled to do or feel guilty about doing or feel anxious about doing.
Great. No, that's what we expect, is to support a person in those better senses of themselves as a feeling choosing person. Of course, existentially, choice is everything. If we feel like we don't have choice, we're in a bad place. But the point is, of course, if we look at it, no matter what choices we've made, we still have all of our choices. So a lot of it is encouraging people to think in a way that they've not been told to think in terms of what their choices might be. The other thing I think, though, in that is, and this I think is really difficult for people who are seeing somebody that they believe is suffering, is that to encourage even going farther into that dark place is scary, both for the person who's encouraging it, and it's certainly scary for the person who's experiencing it. Most people that I experience who are beginning to get in touch with a lot of these feelings get very frightened. If they go there, they'll never come out. If I let myself feel all those feelings, I'll never come out of that. And of course, we know that they will, but it's hard for a lot of people to even have that picture that there is no feeling in the world that is not transitory. Every feeling comes and goes. Otherwise, we'd keep that joy forever. We just bottle it up and keep it. We know how feelings flow. So the darker ones flow like the lighter ones. Damasio says that feelings are the background music of our lives. Feelings in the key of joy. Feelings in the key of pain. If you do something to block the music in the key of pain, you'll never have music in the true feelings of joy. There's something really important about that, that the feelings that we're trying to not feel block us from all of the feelings that we need to be capable of feeling. And antidepressant medication, Peter, as you know, is serious in terms of doing something to this fragile human brain that people lack then the full range of what they're capable of as human beings. And we don't even know whether they can recover from what's this damage that's done. It seems like there's increasing data to suggest that people will have a lot of trouble recovering. Certainly that's why it's, of course, very important for anybody on antidepressant medication to not expect just to quit taking it. Because as you know and I know, that can be really dangerous. You need some help in getting off of these horrible things.
If people want to hear more about the damaging effects of antidepressants, I talk about it in my book, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, the second edition. But you can also, being a modern person, get a good insight into it by going to my blog on Huffington Post. Just plug in BREGGIN. You'll get me and my wife posts. And about my second-ago post is on the persistent harmful effects of antidepressants and how they keep people from recovering. One of the things I'm getting from this conversation is a formulation of depression as a shutdown of all of our faculties because we are afraid of the consequences of our actions or of having painful emotions. I'm putting a little more, just to balance, a little more emphasis on choice and actions, because everything, John, that you're saying about emotions is true about thought and choice, too. People are afraid they can't have a thought, just like they can't have emotion. I can't think about questioning my marriage. I can't think about asking my husband to be responsible. I can't think about my children being more loving and being more disciplined. I can't think about having a better life. If I start thinking, everything will fall apart and I'll give up everything and I'll be irresponsible and I'll be bad, so I won't think about my choices. So I'm seeing depression as a shutdown of thinking and choices and feeling, and the way we experience it most deeply is on the feeling end of it.
Well, Peter, I'd like to just add to that my own observation, that this is what I am observing more than I used to, and I don't know whether it's just because I'm paying more attention or there's just more of it, that I notice that the problem with people who are taking antidepressant drugs seems to affect their thinking even more than their feeling. I mean, the thinking gets really messed up. I mean, people that I've known, and some of them I've known a long time, get into a way of thinking, where did this person go? I mean, the thinking is so illogical. And, of course, it becomes increasingly formulistic. People get more into fundamentalist kinds of things because there's no openness to insight. There's something really bad going on with the thinking part of a person as much as the feeling part of a person.
I think that's absolutely true. Because, you know, we need our frontal lobe function for all the things we're talking about. You know, the way we're different from dogs and monkeys, we have these big foreheads full of frontal lobes. And those frontal lobes were developed to create this tapestry of emotional, social, interpersonal life that we can experience, that no other creature we know of can come close to experiencing. And all psychiatric drugs suppress frontal lobe function. And what is that? That's everything human. That's thinking, judgment, choice-making, insight, love, spirituality. All of it is suppressed by psychoactive substances, whether you're talking about marijuana and alcohol used chronically, or whether you're talking about psychiatric medications of any kind, especially when they're used for months or years at a time. And, you know, the recommendation that you and I seem to be coming up with is find a place, find a person, find the courage to uncork this inhibition on yourself, to dare to have your feelings. You may have to do it a piece at a time. I'm sure you will. We all have to do it a piece at a time. To have your thoughts, to be able to contemplate your choices. You don't in the beginning have to change anything about your life. In fact, when you begin this exploration of yourself, and in particular what's locked under this great inhibition of self we call depression, you know, give yourself a break and not to have to make any decisions right then or to act on any feelings right then, but give yourself the opportunity and have the courage to see what you feel. You don't have to act on it. To experience what you feel. It won't overwhelm or destroy you. It just feels
great.
Like
well,
it.
Well, great,
does.
Peter. One of the things that I've done with the book, and it's part of my life, is that music often has been useful to me in going into the darker places of the human soul. And so I use in the book some selections of music from Mahler that both can take you to the really high, wonderful aspect of just being so glad to be alive, to some of the darker places, because sometimes it seems to me we just need an aid to get to these places. Now, one of my patients says, well, he listens to country music. I get so lonesome I could cry. I mean, and that works too. I mean, but Mahler wrote some songs on the called Kindertotenlieder, songs on the deaths of children. He lost seven of his siblings before he was 12 years old. Anyway, he had a lot of experience with that, including the loss of a beloved six-year-old daughter. Well, Carolyn and I lost a daughter, too, of colon cancer. And there are times when we know we need to go there, and so we put on one of these Kindertotenlieder songs, and it is so, well, actually, one of Mahler's friends said, when he said, Mahler came in when he had written this and said to his friend, I hate for people to have to listen to this. It's so sad. But it helps. Then we can listen to that, and when we cry and we remember Julie, and we feel better for it. So that it's not like we should get over that. It's a matter of being able to allow ourselves to continue to experience that we lost something precious. So that kind of actually going to these places of feeling is important. And sometimes music works really well for that, with that for people. So I basically suggest that as a possibility. But the main thing, of course, is that we don't object to feelings that are very important to us to entitle ourselves to feel.
And those of you listening right now, you can meet John Snyder April 13th through 15th, he's going to do a two-hour breakout workshop. Even if you don't go to his workshop, maybe have dinner with him and his lovely partner. You're going to meet a lot of wonderful people at the Empathic Therapy Conference April 13th through 15th. Go to it at empathictherapy.org. I'm really looking forward to it. I'd like to go to your two-hour conference. I don't know, as I'll be running the show. I don't know if I'll get a chance to go in, but too much. Maybe I'll just poke in and poke out, but I think it's going to be one of our most important presentations.
Well,
and I think today's show on depression is a really important one. John, we have only about 4 minutes left. Think about some of what, you know, how you want to sum up what you're feeling, and be aware we'll be going off the air in about 4 minutes.
Well, first I want to say it's kind of interesting. I'm back on the radio. My father was a newscaster when there used to be things like that, and then he was a manager and then an owner of a radio station. My father would be very glad that I'm back on the radio here. Anyway, that's just interesting to me.
Well,
no, I would say that the main thing that I would say is, of course, just to plug again, Overcoming Depression Without Drugs, the subtitle Mahler's Polka with Introductory Funeral March, is kind of a funeral march of how we've moved into a place of wanting not to feel feelings that are important for us to feel, including a chapter on agitated depression, which is very prevalent. People just staying so busy they don't feel anything, but that's a form of depression and is not being recognized enough. And the answer to it, of course, is the second part of the book, which is go to the feelings. And lots of ways I suggest that people can find ways of moving toward the feelings that one has a hesitation to feel, or objection to feeling, or a considerable dread in feeling. Those are the feelings that people go to their doctor and get prescriptions for antidepressant medication, and it's very, very sad. The marketing of it has made people think they know what depression is. It's feeling these feelings, and it's nothing of the sort. Depression is basically not feeling anything at all, because we're trying so hard not to feel something we don't want to feel. And I guess the summary statement that I would make is that we do not choose our feelings. They choose us. And when we try to choose what we want to feel or what we don't want to feel, we dam up the flow within us. If we block feelings of sadness, we end up not being able to feel anything at all. In short, depression is not a disease. It is a behavior, something we do to ourselves, and we can learn not to do it.
That's beautiful. You have a real gift for talking about human feelings. You're doing a really good job. I want to remind people that the feelings and the choices, the thoughts that you're suppressing when you're depressed, when you shut yourself down in this thing called depression, they could be things that are right there, that are very simple. They could be things that go back a long time. They could go back to early childhood trauma. But they could also go back to feeling trapped at work. They commonly come from our feelings of being overwhelmed with dealing with our children and not knowing how to go about it. They could be connected to real-life stresses. They could be connected to trauma. All of our soldiers who are in combat are traumatized. No way around it. I want to thank John Snyder very, very much for being on the show. And I want to remind you, it's getting down to the wire. That's why I'm reminding you again and again and again to sign up for empathictherapy.org, April 13th through 15th. Hear workshops on how to help the elderly with dementia, without drugs, with empathic therapy. Learn why ADHD is declining in Western Australia because one man has stood up to the doctors. The only place on earth he'll be coming from Australia to tell
Peter,
us about it.
Peter, one final thing. Thank you very much for being there, because you have enabled me not to be so alone in the wilderness. I can be a part of something with you that makes me hopeful. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, John Snyder.
Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.